Margo knew a World War I veteran who was at Mustacast, and she'll tell you the story now.
He was the father of a friend of my sister's, and I had a friend also who lived in the same house with them. So I saw the family quite often. He was considered disabled by the United States government and actually received a disability pension from the government for having been gassed. He was kind of a very strange, quiet fellow, but the story I remember most was his wife, who had very thin hair, not much hair on her head at all. And I would go over there to play with my friend, and this woman would be standing at the stove with the tea kettle boiling and steam coming out of the tea kettle, leaning her head over this tea kettle. And I said to my friend, "Why does she do that?" And my friend said, "She's trying to make her hair grow."
Saturday morning, and we just got back from a 50-minute walk on a really brisk, beautiful, sunny day out. And I'm sitting here getting ready to count my losses in the stock market after the big plunge of the last 2 days. But it just occurred to me, and I want to get something on the record as I cut the banana this morning. I don't know if I've mentioned this on the tape or not, but this has to be part of the permanent record. When we were with Emma Rose, we asked her, "Emma, we know she likes bananas." So we said to her, you like bananas, don't you?" She said, "Oh, I love bananas. I really like them." She says, "Oh, I only like the middle part. Just the middle." Margo and I went to Ireland in 1978, which is now 19 years ago. Not that long ago, really. And Ireland was... I would describe this economically troubled, but thrashing about and trying to decide, and they did. I think when we were there that they would really join the common market, which I think they did. And we were there when they, ever since ever, the Irish punt, which is the Irish pound, was tied to the British pound, and they... while we were there, they cut the Irish pound away, the punt away from the British pound. It immediately fell, stayed depressed the whole time we were there. So Ireland, when we were there, was a sort of a modestly depressed economy, not in the European market or anything like that. Very few women working. It was a surprisingly low amount of women who went to work every day. I think it was like maybe under 10%, but I don't remember exactly. But one of the reasons they did go to work is they didn't have jobs. The men had the jobs, and for other reasons too. I suppose it wasn't their practice for women to work and the like. Well, I saw a report tonight on the tele news. And they talked about Ireland is the fastest growing economy in Europe. They said 40% of the workforce is now women. And they showed size of Dublin, and all the buses were these slick, big, beautiful, modern European diesel German buses that they used to be, these awful English workhorse buses. And the city looked prosperous and everybody well-dressed. My point is, things change in a remarkably short period of time. Now, leading up to yet a point, Margo and I decided we would have some sort of last-minute decision. This is Sunday. We would run to the grocery and buy some tortellini and have some tortellini and cook them in stock, because in any case, I had made some chicken stock. So we ran to the grocery, to Albertson's, about 4:30 this afternoon on Sunday. And I was quite taken in Albertson's. It was quiet. It was really busy. There were, and busy with every, there were profs in there that we knew, there were old women, there were young people, there were obviously college students, it was just a married people, because I know some of them from the town, and, you know, married women and who worked, and there was just a cross-section of people, and you could not tell that this was Albertsons at 4:30 on any other day of the week. I don't think there was nothing, no way you would know this was Sunday or not Wednesday or whatever. It was the same. Now, how my point about Ireland and the point about this story is how things change rapidly. When Mo and I were children, and long afterwards, supermarkets, and there weren't that many then, there certainly were some, I guess, but they didn't open on Sunday. Stores were not open on Sunday. You couldn't go shopping on Sunday. And we lived in some places, and one of them was Kansas, but I think even the South, they had what they called blue laws. And blue laws simply, they were essentially old-fashioned, conservative, and I suppose conservative Christian ideas, although they had wide support among lots of people, that stores didn't open on Sunday. Sunday was not a business day. Sunday was a day of rest, and often you couldn't find places to buy anything, period. Might be one drugstore in the town would be open for emergency medicines or something, but other than that, towns were completely closed down, and there were reasons given, philosophical reasons, saying, you know, it's not fair that workers are exploited and made to work 7 days a week and that kind of thing. So now, from those 1950s in Kansas, and certainly lots of places later, and I suppose even some now, I'm sure you can find some places in Oklahoma or whatever, but that now it's different. Now the stores are open, Sunday's just another day. And part of it goes back to my point about Ireland is now women work. Everybody's working. Everybody's trying to, you know, they're two worker families, extremely common, and the whole economy has changed. So, and it doesn't take long, and the changes occur so rapidly, but when you live in them, you sort of don't notice unless you just go in the Albertsons and say, oh, hey, this looks like Wednesday. I would make another point about this very idea. When we went to Las Vegas, we went out to a suburb of Las Vegas to eat. It was a garlic restaurant. Well, everything, you know how they have 4 stars for hotness or 5 stars? Well, this was 4-star garlic, 5 garlics. So it depends on how much garlic you could tolerate. That's how they rated the dishes. It was located out in the suburbs in a small suburban shopping center. And we were surprised. We went there like 8 o'clock or something like that. And here is a town that runs 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, you know, the way Las Vegas is. There was a barbershop in this shopping center, and it was just open. It was just another day. So Sunday night at 8 p.m. was like Wednesday morning or Thursday afternoon. It was just, the whole economy is geared up to change for this new work ethic, I guess. Marco believes, in thinking about what I said on the tape, that maybe Ellensburg was one of these blue law towns. And you didn't actually necessarily need a law, but I think some places had laws. But it was just that nothing was open. You just couldn't buy. You couldn't buy anything. On Sunday, everything was closed. The other point I would make about Ireland, we predicted, of course, we have no way of knowing, but we love that we're right. We said Ireland will exchange economic prosperity for Irishness, that they will lose the qualities that made Ireland an incredibly wonderful place and a different place. They'll exchange that for European values and European money rates. And I'll tell you, I'll bet Dublin is much more, Dublin 1997 is much more like London 1997 than it is like Dublin 1978, I'll bet. Newsweek this week said that had two numbers that I think are probably surprising to maybe young people today. And maybe to old people today, I don't know. But the figures are this, simply. In 1940, two-thirds of Americans were renters. That means only a third of Americans in 1940 owned their own home. Now, my parents never owned their own home. I don't think they were always renters. I don't ever think they ever talked much about owning their own home. I never heard any conversations about, oh, someday we'll have our own place or whatever. I never heard that. Now, on Margot's end, as far as she can remember, her whole life, she lived in a home that they owned or were paying for. She doesn't ever remember living in a rental. She doesn't know what her parents did when, you know, maybe before she was born, but always they were buying a home. So she was in the one-third of the families that owned their own or were paying for a home, and I lived in the two-thirds that weren't. You know, the other thing is, I don't know, you know, it's hard to remember what you say earlier, but we never owned a car. My father never had a car. He, as far as I know, he didn't know how to drive. And I'm fairly certain, absolutely certain, he didn't know how to drive. And my mother didn't know how to drive. We never had a car. Margot's father, of course, was involved in a business where driving and cars were important. That was, he was, of course, a funeral director. The other thing is, my family never owned a telephone. I grew up without a telephone. Now, just think of that. I grew up without a telephone. Of course, again, Margot always had a telephone because the nature of her father's business, which was conducted, I guess, mostly in their home, was he needed cars, you know, and he needed a telephone. So really rather different. I would footnote my position a little bit by saying this, that, you know, if you think about it, I was raised by a father who didn't know anything about cars. He didn't tinker with them, you know, and of course cars back years ago were not as reliable as they are, and not as complicated. People often repaired their own cars, and it was sort of required almost that you could, you know, fix a lot of things under your hood. My father didn't do that, and I was not raised in a family where things like, I don't know, washers were changed in the sink, or storm windows were taken on and off, that kind of thing, the normal homeowner thing. Shrubs were removed and trees were planted. I didn't, none of that. So in a sense, I think that I was raised by parents, and especially my father, who you could not consider him to have been handy. He was not handy. He didn't do the typical handy things that American men are expected to do. Now, the other number that Newsweek had was in 1940, only 1 in 9 Americans were high school graduates. Think of that. Only 1 in 9 in 1940 were high school graduates. Now, Margot's mother was a high school graduate, very proud of it, of course. That was an accomplishment. And my mother was a high school graduate. She was very proud of that fact. Margot's father, she thinks, had maybe fourth grade education. So he was, you know, just think about that. He went to work after the fourth grade. And these things were often typically economic reasons. They didn't drop out because they couldn't cut the mustard. They dropped out because they had to go to work and support the family or whatever. I'm uncertain about my father. Although I'm fairly kind of sure, let's put it that way. I don't think my father was a high school graduate. Now, I think there was a sort of a fudge factor went on in my family that there was an implication that he was, but I'm not really sure that he ever graduated from high school. And, but as I say, I don't know. And I have no sense that any of his brothers or sister, that any of them went to school much, I mean beyond, certainly not beyond high school. Now, as far as going beyond school, beyond high school, Phyllis, Margot's sister, went to junior college. She was the first one of that whole crew to go on to higher ed, we could say. And then, of course, Margot went to the University of Michigan in 1948. But just think about this. In 1940, one in nine Americans graduated from high school. And what a singular thing it is in 1948 for Margot to go on to be accepted and attend the University of Michigan. What an incredible change. P.S. Regina, Margot's older sister, was a graduate of nursing school, which I think was, certainly that was post-high school, and there was a course of, I suppose, at least 2 years. And I think in those days, often, you learned to be a nurse in a hospital. There was a nursing program in some hospitals that you could attend and learn to be a nurse. And then, of course, my brother came back from World War II, and the GI Bill, which is really one of the miracles of America. The GI Bill is probably the best program the United States government ever had, bar none. He went to, I think, Hunter College in New York City, and then he went to University of Wisconsin for the summer or whatever. So he really broke the ice in my family as far as higher ed was concerned. Now, as far as being raised in families that valued or didn't value education, we don't know about Margot's dad because he died when Margot was around 12. So we don't know if he had a view one way or the other. Margot's mother she was not a big pro-education person, at least as far as women were concerned. I don't. If you went on to be a teacher or something, that would be okay. But just to get an education, I don't think Mrs. Blanchett was very keen on that. I think she thought that was probably a waste of time. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I don't really remember a view from my father that he thought education was important or not. He had some pretensions of, I think, of acting educated. And he liked educated people, I think, but I'm not sure he had a view as far as his kids, or at least I don't know what it was. On the other hand, my mother thought education was wonderful, and she thought it was really good to go on to college and do that. And it seems to me one of the things she always said was, Jews do that. It's important. Jews, they know the value. Jews know the value of hard work and education. This sort of, it seems to me, one of the models I heard when I was a kid. Margot and I decided somewhere along the line, early on, I guess, that we should try to eat together one meal, like supper, as a family unit. So we really tried hard to do that and to make sure that the four of us had supper together every night. Now, so it's hard to do, but we were, I think, pretty successful. And we think it hasn't too much to do with eating. It has to do with being a family and a family unit.
When John F. Kennedy was running for president of the United States the first time, the only time, I guess, I did a lot of reading about him and about Nixon, and one of the things that I read that really impressed me was that his mother and father, John F. Kennedy's mother and father, insisted that every night they eat together. They eat dinner together, the whole family, and they had seven or eight kids. And what they used to do was they gave the children a topic that was going to be discussed at the dinner table. And each of the children was to come to the table prepared to discuss this topic. Now, I didn't think you needed to give the children a topic to discuss, but I thought, what a good idea for everybody to come together, sit around the table, doing a communal thing, such as eating, and discussing the events of the day. And it did turn out often that Quentin and I acted as devil's advocate to the children's ideas, because we wanted them to learn to think and to figure out why they believed the things they believed in.
Now, we know at least several families, and now, and our age, or maybe a little younger, and they don't eat together. In fact, when I thought about this as a topic, I talked to a man who's a couple of years younger than I am, and he has three children, and he said, he made excuses why his family didn't do that. And of course, the excuses are always out there, you know, music lessons, soccer, hockey game, we're going to the movies. That, you know, if you want excuses, there's always reasons why your family doesn't have to eat together. And once you allow that to happen, then in fact you don't eat together. But he said to me, it was uncommon by the time, say, his kids started in high school, they wouldn't eat together once a month. And we knew a family, they lived next to us, they never sat down. There was only three of them, mother, father, and a son and a daughter. Daughter often adult, not there. They never sat down to eat together. The mother would be watching TV, the father wasn't hungry, the son would be in the kitchen eating, or some variation of that. So that they simply never sat down as a family unit together, except, I suppose, in front of a TV when they didn't talk to each other. One final P.S. Margot had a conversation with a black woman, and she will share it with you.
What she said to me was, one of the things that the blacks needed to find out in order to learn how to get along in society in the United States was what white families talked about around the dinner table every night.
Margo and I went grocery shopping today, this morning, and we thought we'd maybe have a bowl of vegetable soup sometime this week. So we got some soup bones from the grocery store. They were $2. $2 for 2 1/4 pounds of extremely well-picked bones. There wasn't a milligram of meat on any of them. And I realized and thought I should mention this. Years ago, when we were kids, bones were free. If you could go to the store and buy some ground meat or, you know, a steak or whatever, and you could tell the butcher, wrap up some bones, soup bones for me, and he would, and they wouldn't charge you anything. Soup bones were free. Now they're $1 a pound. Margo also thinks that she remembers when the butcher would give you free liver, like beef liver for your cat. You could just say to the guy, you know, give me a little liver for my kitty, and he'd wrap it up, and it'd be free. They wouldn't charge you for that. So how things have changed. I saw a copy of Family Circle magazine, which is a magazine that sold, I think, as far as my memory and whatever is right, Family Circle's only sold through grocery stores. It's a standard size magazine of pretty good size, really. The price of it, I think, was, I saw it 2 days ago, I think it was $1.39. I remember when Family Circle came out. It came out in a grocery chain and was sold at the counter, and it was sold for a nickel. It's probably the cheapest magazine bargain you could buy in the history of this century in America. Margot seems to recall that Family Circle sold for 10 cents in the 50s, and she also said that probably it's still the cheapest magazine you can buy on anywhere for $1.39. Probably true, I guess. This weekend, Margo and I had an opportunity to see some examples of, I suppose you'd call it theater of the absurd, which were short vignettes, I suppose, theatrical vignettes, filled with I think, existential angst, glazed over with pathos, and an invitation to deconstruction. What these were, I'll attempt to describe a couple of them. Emma Rose. Okay, now get back to being serious here. Emma Rose had fashioned a crutch. Don't ask me why she did this, but she constructed a crutch out of sticks and about $40 worth of tape. And she was limping around, and we constructed several wonderful little plays, I guess you'd call them, filled with, energized with meaning, I thought. I'll describe two of them we did. In one, Emma Rose is walking along, but carrying a crutch. She's not limping or anything. She's just walking, carrying this crutch. And I called her over, and I said, "Come here, little girl." And I put my hand on her head, and I said, "Heel, heel." And she immediately put a crutch under her arm and limped off. Now, in the other one, which I thought was the most poignant, she came limping in, this poor little match girl of Athens, or that's not the Sparta. No, I've got to, trying to think of, there's a famous work of art, Little Blind Girl of Carthage, I guess it's called, done in the 1880s. She's, anyway, Emma comes limping in on a crutch. And I call her over and I say, "Come here, little girl." I put my hand on her forehead and I said, "Heel, heel, throw away that crutch." And she did, and then she immediately collapsed to the rug. And these were rather incredibly touching. I think just touching dramas. I think I should mention the third one, the third skit we did. Emma came in and not only not limping, but she was essentially leading a big brass military band with her crutch. Da 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 da, you know, kind of. I said, "Little girl, come over here." And she walked over to me. And then I gave her a karate chop on her knee. And she then put the crutch on her arm and limped off. You know, though, the point of this, these little skits is Emma's 9. And Emma understood these, and she even invented, she said, Gannett, come here, let's come here, I have an idea for a skit, you know. So, this is a 9-year-old girl that understands things that are probably on the equal of Waiting for Godot. In 1985, we decided that we would purchase some wines to celebrate events in Ethan's life. And then later, after Emma Rose was born, we did the same thing. So, and we've had them stored. The only problem was 81, the year of Ethan's birth, was not a good big red wine year, so we bought some good 81 wines, keepers if you want, but we also bought 82s and 83s, which were better years, and we've shared these with the John family periodically. We had some of Ethan's wine when he was baptized. Margaret thinks we maybe had some wine when he reached his teen years, 13. And then this year we took over a bottle of nice 81 red wine, and then I guess an 82 red wine to celebrate his 16th birthday. So I was looking at our inventory list, and we're down to only one or two bottles of 81 wines, but lots of 83s, and now Emma's year was a really good year, I guess, for wine, and we bought a whole bunch of 88s, so we'll try to celebrate those when it's appropriate. It's a nice little, I don't know, custom to do, and we've enjoyed doing it. And these old wines, you know, 16 years old, they're just really glorious. We have a winekeeper, so it's no work on the whole part, just to keep them and remember to use a bottle now and again. We went over this year to celebrate Ethan's birthday, and we didn't see him a great deal. He was off on candidates, debates, and all the things that young guys do. But one thing was, he won a prize in a debate, and everybody was sort of tickled pink and very proud that he won that. He's turned out to be a really nice young man, tall, getting quite tall and rangy, handsome as a devil, and really bright.